Welcome to Right Here in Mass. We're a weekly podcast that features individuals throughout the Bay State who are on our radar and should be on yours. From the Berkshires to Boston, Cape Cod and the Islands, tune in to learn about who you should know right here in Mass. We're back with another episode of Right Here in Mass. Joining us today is Kevin Rothschild Shea, the founder of Architecture Environment Life Incorporated, which he started in 2008 after working for a local firm specializing in housing projects for 18 years. Kevin is currently licensed in Massachusetts and Connecticut and holds memberships with the National Council of Architectural Registration Board and the American Institute of Architects, also known as AIA. Kevin, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Nice to meet you. Nice to see you today.
Likewise. Please share with our audience more about you and what you do.
Sure. So we are a Western Mass based firm. We're in Asaw Meadow, just a couple miles outside of Springfield. We are a firm of about currently seven people. Historically, we run around seven to nine. We're a firm that essentially evolved from a kind of a jack of all trades firm in Western Mass. You do a little bit of everything, but we have developed or evolved into a specialty of offering a multifamily residential housing. That's really evolved into the core of our work, with the affordable housing really being the center of the multifamily. We do have some market rate residential, and we do enjoy a few custom residential projects here and there as well. But we, being the jack of all trades, we'll say we do commercial, medical, retail, industrial, a little bit of municipal work, a little bit of historic. So we kind of touch on a lot of different projects.
And what made you want to focus on or specialize in the multifamily specifically?
I think it kind of evolved over time. In my first leg of my career, I worked at a small firm also in Western Mass that did a lot of multifamily, a lot of HUD housing projects back in the day when, when there were lots of HUD, a lot of elderly projects out on the books. They started that firm with a focus in the 70s, and that just kept running right up into the 80s and 90s. So when I went out on my own, we had some of those connections in place, and gradually over time, they just kind of gained traction and took hold, especially as the natural evolution of things. Some of the original firms in Western Mass retired or closed up shop. We ended up being in a great position of being an experienced firm, having the connections, and having built up the business kind of ready to step into that niche. So it's one of those things that kind of has a ways working out, but one thing leads to the next. Here we are.
And with being licensed in both Massachusetts and Connecticut, would you say that most of your work goes over towards the western part of the state, or do you kind of travel all throughout Massachusetts and different parts of Connecticut?
I would say our trade is pretty regional. We do see firms from east, especially Worcester or Boston, coming out this way on occasion, although the market is a little different in Western Mass versus the Boston metro area, especially as it relates to price point. But for us, we're so close to Connecticut. It's just a few miles south to the Connecticut line. That the Hartford, Western Connecticut area is very similar to the market in Western Mass, the Springfield area. So those two kind of fit together nicely. Most of our work is in Western Mass, probably within 25 miles of the office here. We do have a client, the Community Builders, we're working on two projects in Worcester with, and those are both affordable housing. One is an SRO. The other is a family housing project, which we're developing for funding. So those are within the reach without spending too much time traveling. I think both sites are within 45 minutes of the office, and those make it pretty manageable. But generally speaking, we service the projects through the life of construction. So you want to be reasonably close to the project. you don't want to be in the car all day, all week, and clients don't really want to be paying for travel time. So,
right. And for the residential projects that you work on specifically, would you say that it's the developers and builders who hire you, or do homeowners themselves ever hire you directly? How does that typically look?
I guess it's all of the above. The smaller custom single family, those are the homeowners and the individuals hiring us. Usually those people that are hiring us have a very specific project with very specific design goals that the average homeowner and contractor can't solve or produce themselves. So they basically elevate to a design firm like ourselves to help them develop the vision and put the lines on paper and help them get it built. A lot of our multifamily projects, those are handled by professional developers. They're big projects. They take many years to develop. Lots of funding requirements, whether it's privately financed or through the state. So those can be years in the making, and you got to have some pretty significant wherewithal to manage and develop and finance those projects. So we're bidding one now that has a 2018 project date, and we're just going to bid now. So we started over 4 years ago. So they take years to develop, years to get permitted, to get funded, eventually, hopefully, to get a shovel in the ground. So, and that's similar. We work with private developers that may develop for profit versus the developers that are working in the affordable housing market. They're really, their goal is more mission-based. They're looking to serve the need and develop to fit the need and work for a cause. They're strongly motivated to develop affordable housing, good, safe places for people to live. So they're a wonderful group of people to work with. They have a great, strong mission. So we've enjoyed that work.
I imagine. And with the lifespan of projects potentially being so long, how do you manage that with your workflow? Where if you come across a project in 2018, like you mentioned, but now it's almost 5 years later and you're just going to bid, how does that affect all your other projects?
Oh, it's a challenge. It's usually they all hit at once when you least expect it.
I bet.
So, and then it's impossible to predict. It's basically a never ending juggle. A lot of these projects that do live long lives will have a very intense period from, 8 to 12 or 24 weeks. And then it'll go into the state for funding. It'll sit on the shelf for 6 or 8 months. And if in the case of a public project, if it doesn't get funded, then you may spend 4 or 6 weeks advancing the work, refining the cost estimate, and then resubmitting again, in which case then your pencils are down for another 6 or 8 months. Then you wait. And if you get funded, then the mission is to pick it up and finish all the drawings as quickly as possible and then get it out to finally, and then begin a 12 to 24 month construction process. So this past year, I think we had 3 of them that all ran in parallel.
Oh, wow.
Alternating cycle. So it was kind of the perfect storm of the worst possible schedule.
I bet.
And you can't just have triple the staff hanging around waiting for some of the projects to land all at once. So it basically means, and it's pretty traditional in our trade where you hustle when you have to, and then in the in-between off cycle, you're doing smaller projects like a small medical office or small residential. And that's where the little projects kind of fill in the blanks and kind of stretch things out and even out the year. But it is very difficult to plan and schedule because one day you may have a project, and the next day you don't have a project for another 12 months.
Right. Yeah. So it's just the unknown ultimately.
Oh, yeah. It's you're always kind of rolling with the flow. It's very, you can plan as far as you can plan. And then after that, you just kind of just keep hustling.
Right. And with those projects that do end up happening all at once, do you ever hire people temporarily if you find that you are overloaded with work, or do you kind of tend to stick to your core 7 to 9 staff member team?
We have brought in other people depending on the task and the opportunity. If we have a small project, if we're just absolutely swamped, if we can hand an entire small project to a known entity, we will. Or if we have small consulting or code type, you know, we may have small in between those huge projects. We may have a small task that might be a code review of a building or a compliance issue or an inspection problem from a city that the client's been notified of. And sometimes we can isolate those smaller tasks and hand them out to other architects or other sole practitioners that we know and our friends and that we work with. But for the most part, we juggle and buckle down with our own team, because a lot of times by the time you hand it out, explain to somebody what you need done, get it in and out, check it, go back and forth, you almost could have just kept up with the work yourself.
So, right.
It's always a juggle, but even currently we're looking to hire, we're interviewing third party drafters and contractors, just so that we always have two or three options at our disposal.
That's smart. Just so in case something does come up, you're prepared and ready to take it on.
Yes, because it's the workforce has certainly been a challenge this last couple of years, especially post COVID. Also been a challenge in Western Mass. We may not have the same fun factor as some of the Boston metro areas. The youngsters coming out of college might be more excited to go, you know, shack up with a bunch of friends and have fun in the city. You know, even though Western Mass living is nice, we have fresh air and lots of green hills
and trees.
But the market has been a challenge for everybody. I think across the state, architects and engineers have been struggling to find enough people to augment their team.
Right, right. And with all the different sectors that you focus on, with residential, commercial, industrial, all of that, did you always work in all of those sectors, or did you kind of start with one and then expand from there, or what was that process like?
Well, I guess the firm I started with for the first 18 years of my career, they were similarly diverse for the same reasons that you kind of need to be diverse out here. I think in Western Mass, there's a couple firms that have limited their focus to municipal, like schools or senior centers or libraries. But for the most part, most of the other firms are a little bit more diverse. So early on and throughout our career, I've always had exposure to commercial and medical, historic type projects, just because out here in Western Mass, we're surrounded with lots of old buildings. Daycare, childcare, we were fortunate to have an early introduction into those types of projects. And then over 20, 30 years, you kind of just get that accumulated knowledge for each project type. So, I mean, if you come in most areas where you go looking for architect, you may not find too many that might specialize in a warehouse or industrial type space. Mm-hmm. There might be a firm down south in the Midwest, but then those firms are not necessarily experienced in working in the area.
Exactly. Yeah. And with all of the projects that you worked on throughout your career, would you say that you have a handful or a few that are your favorites to date?
Oh boy. It's probably always the next one is the next best favorite. So as designers, we're always excited about the next new thing. But yeah, we've had, and it's funny with our industry, you know, we're designing and we have a product, but we're also client and customer service oriented. So underlying the delivery of and the construction of a building, we're really meeting the needs of a client. And so we're kind of in that service sector. So there have been some very small projects that you wouldn't even recognize where we did great work for the client. We helped them solve a problem, get something done on budget. So those are the hidden things that you do. But we certainly have been fortunate with a few nice little houses that we've worked on. Our work with... New Valley Bank in Springfield. We did their first branch bank. That was really fun. It was Rick Morris from my office kind of led the design on that. We took some terrible 1970s bank and made it new again. and clean and current. One of our bigger clients, Home City Housing, that does a lot of the affordable work. I think we transformed 75, 2, 3, 4, 6 family homes from old ramshackle houses into nice, clean, new places to live. With the community builders, we helped them with phase two of 80, I think it was around 80 units of housing and a community center up in Holyoke. And then little small partners, the hot table, the sandwich shop out here is a local family created chain. And we met them shortly after they'd done their first or second store, which the first two they did with no architect, kind of seat of the pants grassroots. And then they realized, well, if they're going to keep doing this, the inspectors were calling them to get an architect. So then we met them and helped them produce, I think, the next three. And now they've gone on and now they have a branded restaurant specialty architect alone, one of the few. And so they moved on to a different firm, which is fine and wonderful. But that relationship and that work was always nice. It was fun to transform. They were fun to work with. And they were much like us, small business, entrepreneurial, starting things from, you know, bootstrapping and ground up, you know, literally out grabbing the groceries themselves. They weren't even, you know, fully blown up to the point where they had food service delivery and everything. So, so there's a lot over the years. We did a great daycare center for Valley Opportunity Council in Chicopee. So a lot of them aren't just the building. It's really the kind of the quality of the experience of the service and how much it served or helped the client in the process. So,
right. And when your clients come to you, do they usually have a very specific idea in mind of what they need, or do they come to you and almost need you to help lay it out what they might need and help to massage that idea or concept further?
That's a good question. I guess it's full spectrum, just like our clients. The professional developers, this is their business, their stock and trade. So they know what they're looking for. They know what to expect out of architects. And they know how to build and develop. So they're usually pretty clear about what it is they're trying to do. On the other side of the spectrum, with all our smaller projects and local and homeowners, sometimes they just come with a bunch of wrinkled up paper. We've seen people draw floor plans in Excel by just highlighting the edges of cells to create a plan. Amazing use of Excel, not for its design intent. To scribbles, to notes, in which case sometimes you just have to interpret what it is they want. So a lot of what we need to do is be able to read the client, understand what they're trying to ask for, what they're trying to communicate. Sometimes it's written, sometimes it's drawn. Sometimes it's a jumble of all of the above. So it's pretty easy to tell once you've been doing this for 20 or 30 years. We can always tell when we have a homeowner or a smaller commercial client, you know, even a doctor in a small doctor's office. They just know they need to have so many exam rooms and so much XYZ, so many receptionists, so many chairs in a waiting room. And then we just take that, you know, kind of put it in the soup, stir it around, and come up with usually 1, 2, 3 different design schemes to see what fits. And then we, you know, evaluate that and massage and then advance. But a lot of our people come to us without having any idea of either how to read a plan or how to even decide what to do. And that's where we get to kind of, you know, juggle it all in, put all the ingredients into a pot and try to come out with a good looking plan.
And I imagine that's probably one of the funnest parts about what you do is just having that creative freedom with each project and being able to take the information that you have and be able to create something based on what the client is looking for.
Yeah, it's fun. And that same diversity too, because we're There might be some firms in the state or in the country that will, if you go to them, you're going to get modern architecture. If you go to them, you're going to get a traditional historic building. Our design response is really based on a response that fits the need. We're doing a residential project. It's in the country, and that needs to be a good rural fit. That design approach may not be, my favorite piece of modern architecture, but it's the best fit for the building and the project and the client. Somebody else might be in a modern building or an old mill. And the big thing is to recognize where you're working, what the context is, and design something that's a good, appropriate fit. Sometimes that fit is a modern contrast to an old building. We all see that. And sometimes it is a historically correct replication of that building. So it's kind of, knowing when to step on the gas and when to put foot on the brake.
Right. And I like that approach because then you're not just kind of stuck in one lane. You're able to take all of these different aspects based on the part of the state that you're in and the project that you're looking for. I feel like it's kind of funny around here where I am. My fiance and I bought new construction, but he knows our builder because he's a plumber, and he always calls them like the Jamie houses, because you can drive through our towns and see like the houses that just all look the same. And he calls them the cookie cutter colonials. And so it's just kind of funny where you can drive by and be like, oh, I bet so-and-so built that. And so it's nice that you have your own stamp and be able to do things that are different without being so recognizable.
Right. And that's when people come to us, because what we tend to do is a one-off, right? The builders you're talking about, we have the same ones in town. You can go on the internet and buy a set of house plans, and you pay a little extra, and you have not the, when you buy those, they're buying the license to either build it once, or if you pay extra, you can build it endlessly. So if you buy a license to repeat it as many times as you want, they'll buy two or three house plans and they just pop them in wherever. That can be nice, and it can be dangerous, because sometimes they're just putting up houses that don't really belong there. Contextually, it may just not be the right fit. And you look at it like, how did that get there? And then little things like on design, what's the orientation, right? Your kitchen or living room is facing north. You never get any sun. It's always cold. When we design a house, you like to, maybe put the garage on the cold side, insulate or buffer the house. Maybe the bedroom or master or the great room have the view, not the view of the front lawn or your alley, right? What we do is design to fit the program and the site, not just stick the plan that we bought off the internet onto a chunk of land and do it as many times as possible to make as much money as possible. But
right.
Noble benefit to both, I guess.
Yeah, I bet. And with the work that you do, do you incorporate sustainability or like energy efficiency at all?
Yeah, that's been one of the nice nice pieces of our work and our career. In Massachusetts, Massachusetts generally is one of the most progressive states, maybe right up there after California. In terms of code and energy sustainable design requirements in the code. And then also one of the lead funders, Department of Housing and Community Development, DHCD, requires in their affordable housing for them to be sustainable, high performing, and well built according to environmental standards, whether it's recycling pre and post construction content and materials, just because the act of construction needs to be good for the environment. It needs to be affordable to maintain. It does no good to build an affordable house or apartment and then have to pay exorbitant utility bills trying to heat it. So some of the trends that we're seeing, both we're doing one project that's a Energy Star Level 2. It's very high performing, very tight envelope. It's all electrified, no fossil fuels. And this is all with an eye towards carbon reduction in the environment. And DHCD has done similarly, where they really suggest and want to see their clients coming through with what's called a passive house. It's Passive House Institute US, FIIS. And that is a very high standard in terms of heating, mechanicals, electrical, building envelope, windows. Everything is very high performing. You spend a little more on the construction, everything from managing the vapor barrier, the air barrier, the weather, thermal transmission of blocking and nails through the building. So that when you're done, these things just sip the energy. They just, it's a great mission. And all the while looking at to do it with sustainable, recyclable content, low VOC paints or no VOC paints. So it's, and that is working its way into everyday building. Massachusetts just passed the new energy code, which is coming through now through July, continuing to increase the standards. And that's been a nice kind of cornerstone of everything we do. We try to work it into every possible project we can, because failing to do so, all you're going to do is increase your reliance on utilities or fossil fuels.
Right. And so, like you said, spending a little bit more money up front will save you money in the long run. And then also, you know that you're doing what's right for the environment.
Yep. It's kind of a win-win for everybody. Generally speaking, most of our clients are pretty well educated, and we're a pretty progressive state here. There are some people that just want to do it the same old way, you know, how it should breathe, aka leak energy and money right out the windows. But it's generally speaking, we're lucky to be here, and the technology is ever changing and really advancing. So that's been one of the biggest career developments, I think, in the last even 5 years. It's really, really taken off. So kind of good for everybody.
Absolutely. And speaking of career developments, what made you want to go into architecture in the beginning and just kind of having this as your career?
I guess most architects tell you it's kind of a curse and a blessing, right? Because it's one of those things, once you want to do it, even if you can't sleep at night, you're kind of sucked in to the light. I think it came for me when I was a kid. We hired some guy to draw blueprints to put an addition on our house for like a garage and a family room. And, you know, that kind of always stuck with me. I was interested in it in high school. You take the tech drawing classes where they teach you to draw. In my day, with a T-square and a mechanical pencil, and you drew gears and all that stuff. And then I went to school for 1 year, basically I was in college, we'll call it a gap year, basically figure out what you want to do. Decided that's really where I wanted to go. And then I applied to Roger Williams, where Megan Chick Media is currently teaching a marketing class this semester. She also went there. And that was the beginning of the career. So, and that's college's minimum for architects. It's 5 years for a bachelor's of architecture, not a bachelor of science or arts. It's a bachelor of art, or it's a 4+2, 6 years, undergrad and master's. And then once you're done, you're looking at a 2.5 year internship. Then there's NCARB administers a series of, I think there's 7 tests now. So once you accumulate so many hours worked under supervision of a licensed architect, then you qualify to take the tests. So this is like 3 years after your 5 or 6 years, wow, you qualify to take your tests. And then once you pass all those, then you can, then you're fortunate enough to pay them for your license.
Yeah. And when you worked for the other firm, what encouraged you to be able to start your own firm and kind of step away from where you were when you started your career?
Well, probably like many things, I guess my career there hit a crossroads, or at least a fork in the road. And we'll say that I chose this one and ultimately chose to not stay with that firm and go off on my own. So it was just a little bit of one of those things that just kind of didn't work out as expected or as planned. And then in the end has certainly worked out pretty well. So we're pretty happy with how things have gone.
Absolutely. And for anyone listening to this episode who might be considering going into architecture and making that their career, what advice do you have for them?
Well, let's see. Your high school guidance counselor might tell you to take a lot of math classes. I would suggest you take, if you're headed into the traditional creative design side of the field, I would strongly suggest you take the art classes, the painting, sculpture, maybe the tech drawing, because those are the creative thinking side of the brain. You do need to be good at math, to be successful in the design side of the career, to be the creative side of the career, you really need to kind of exercise that side of your brain. Most colleges require a portfolio to apply for design school, so you're going to be needing to create and build up that kind of resume and that portfolio of design work anyway. And I think that's that kind of critical thinking, that kind of problem solving, that kind of design problem solving, that's what will carry you not just into college, but that's the core of what we do as in the career. Of course, there are some parts where people write specs. They want to be, you know, I went to school with a young guy and he wanted to be the business manager. He liked the business of running a design firm. He wanted to know everything about how to be an architect, but he wasn't interested in being a stellar architect. He wanted to be the businessman. So he was getting 2 degrees, one in business and one in design. So like anything else within the field of architecture, there's lots of subcategories and little niches that you can settle into.
Right. And at the beginning of this episode, when we gave an overview of who you are, we had mentioned that there are a few different organizations that you're a member of. And would you say that that's something that you recommend, is getting involved in architectural organizations or professional networks such as that?
Yeah, those always help. For instance, the AIA has regional chapters. There's a Western Mass chapter of AIA, and students can become associate, or sometimes there's a student membership version available to them. Those memberships never hurt. Traditionally, professionally, they support us, especially AIA, because they have all the support for contract documents, spec writing software, lots of professional development support, a lot of continuing education support. So those things are more specifically geared towards us. It never hurts to be involved with some of these or to be aware of them. But I think the core of it comes down to, you know, the schooling and the close to home. And I know now a lot of the schools, if you're interested in it, you can go like up to UMass and do a 2 week, and a lot of other schools do it. You can go for a 2 or 4 or 6 week summer session and have a trial practice. So if you're a junior in high school, you want to see what it's like to go to architecture school. It's kind of like architecture camp. You can go up there, hang out with a bunch of like-minded people and design things and build models and hopefully have a little fun in the process. So a lot of opportunities those kinds of things didn't exist then when I went to school, but they are great for the kids now, though, for sure.
Yeah, they're nice to take advantage of. And I believe that you're also a board member for a few different organizations. Is that right?
Not serving any longer, but yeah, typically it's not unusual for either people like us, either both in business or in the design field, to serve either on board or local committee or membership capacity. So as business owner, we participated in with other local boards, and those are good in terms of connections in business and connection with your peers locally. And then regionally, I was on the historic district study committee in my town, and I chaired the town. And we've served supporting roles with other local boards. Those are basically either opportunities to extend kind of as a public service, extend your knowledge base and your capability out to the public arena, where in general, the towns have vault committees that are constituted volunteers, planning boards, zoning boards, like the historic district committee or historic society or historic committees. And there's not that many people that are actually familiar with design or construction. So it's one of those things that comes with a calling is to offer the service and support your town in those capacities. And some of the towns have requirements where you need at least one person that's from the construction field, maybe one that might have legal experience.
Right.
So some of the committees have a required diversification. So sometimes the committees will come looking for you. And if you live in a small town, they will quickly find out who you are and what you do and try to get you to come out and help them out.
Yeah, I bet. And on the topic of local organizations, what would you say are your favorite local businesses to support?
Let's see. So I guess there's a handful. So the one thing is that we're our life is built and centered here in Western Mass. I will say we are growing slowly, gradually out to extend some business out onto the Cape. We have a long-time family presence out on the Cape. My daughter lives in Harwichport right now. My in-laws are out there, and that's a place that we've spent a lot of time. So I know on the Cape, there's a handful of institutions or businesses that are definitely worthy of support. Capabilities mm-hmm. is one. We've done a little support design work for them, but they provide opportunities and services for people with different needs. They run a farm, employment opportunities, supportive housing for people. Then there's some great restaurants, everything from Three Monkeys and Mad Minnow to, favorite restaurants all around us. Western Mass, I kind of mentioned a couple of our either clients or partners clients that we work with. But we also have a handful of partners that are critical to what we do. Landscape architects like Berkshire Design in Northampton, Bill Cannon in East Hampton, mechanical engineers like Robert Hall over here in Agawam, a group called BLW out by Worcester, Lang and Environmental does site and civil work internationally. We've had the opportunity to work with them. So we're pretty fortunate to be able to kind of touch on both on a personal support level as well as to both bring on some of these businesses, some women and minority owned, and bring them into the fold. And then we're also fortunate to be consulting to or working for a pretty diverse client base. So indirectly, we're supporting them and they're helping us too. So it's a pretty symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely. I love that. Kevin, this has been such an awesome episode, and I've really enjoyed learning all that you've done in your career and the exciting projects that you've worked on. And I'd love if you could share with our audience where they can find you online in case they'd like to connect with you further.
Oh, sure. You can find us at, I think, www.architectureel.com. So we are a Western Mass and Cape centric firm specializing in multifamily housing, but as we said, we can handle almost any of your design needs.
Perfect. And I will link to that in the show notes so that way our listeners can connect with you from there. But thank you so much for being a guest on today's show.
Great. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Right Here in Mass. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed recording it. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, follow us on social media, and share our podcast with your network. See you next week.